This is Limitless Possibility. I'm Luc Olivier de Mablet.
And I'm Yannick Magnan.
And what's our topic for this week, Yannick?
What's going on with Xbox?
Ooh, but first, we have some follow-up.
Yep, so I'm going to open up with some follow-up for episode 200, which was Social Media Grief Counselor, the episode we did about various kinds of social media. I have some fresh new Mastodon drama to drop on the podcast, and this is half follow-up and half potentially a warning to some of you. So on May 1st, Eugen Rotko, which is the founder and CEO of Mastodon, announced that they would facilitate onboarding to the Fediverse by making Mastodon.social signups open again and default to that instance in the Mastodon mobile app. Shortly thereafter, what ended up happening was that spam accounts began flocking onto Mastodon.social and DMing people crypto links. Great. And of course, the moderation staff in place at the instance was not able to keep up with the pace of the spammers, which has been causing chaos across the Fediverse over the past few weeks. And because of these incidents, numerous instances have been threatening to defederate from Mastodon.social, and doing so would be cutting off lots of users from the largest Mastodon instance from their instances and vice versa. So if you, for some reason, stop being able to reach the Limitless Possibility and Nicole Vieux's accounts on the Fediverse, this may be why. To be clear, this is not the first time there have been threats of potential mass defederation from Mastodon.social. Funnily enough, there was one that was ongoing while the massive Twitter exodus was happening. And people, like, that week had still been discussing mass defederation from Mastodon.social, and we dodged it that time. But I don't know how many incidents of these are going to have to happen before it actually does happen. When we were actually discussing where we were going to put the podcast account, I had tried to get the podcast account on another instance because I was aware that this drama was happening and I thought there was a risk involved in putting it on Mastodon.social. But ultimately, it was, just like for regular users, too challenging to actually find an instance that we'd be welcome in. So we just defaulted to Mastodon.social, and we might now be paying the price for this. So I guess stay tuned for future episodes to find out if we move our account. But for the moment, we're just going to be staying there unless instances actually do begin to defederate. I do also want to point to a really good thread by Daniel Lowe about how IRC's origins were very similar to the Fediverse. And eventually that morphed into a world where instances are closed by default and federate only with selected vetted instances. And basically, like, his conclusion is this is a human problem, not a technology problem. And it seems almost inevitable that the Fediverse will sort of become multiple clusters of instances that talk to each other instead of one large network where everyone gets along, because clearly, as we've demonstrated, people don't get along.
Which is an interesting take about, I'm not surprised that it might end up being like closed by default and then open when needed. And it's kind of interesting. I'm slowly, again, as usual, slowly catching up on my podcast queue. So I'm kind of getting through the, late April, early May. Oh my God. I have a blue sky, / Twitter, yeah, invite and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, this is, A, I don't have an invite, and I don't really care, to be honest. We'll see where the Apple dev community moves, or if it does move again. That's going to be interesting to see. But what I'm worried about is a lot of people saying it feels more like Twitter, and I'm like, yeah, but it's supposed to be an open protocol, but there's only one instance. And then what happens if people want to create new instances? This seems to be kind of missing in action right now. So I'm not eager to see what's happening there, but it feels that we're not skipping the drama, whether you are on Blue Sky or on the Fediverse.
What's really interesting, first of all, I've gotten requests from some of the listeners of the podcast that we do an episode on what we think about Mastodon a few months in and Blue Sky and everything like that. And of course, that is conditional on me getting an invite, and I don't think I know anyone who actually cares about Blue Sky, therefore I don't think I'm going to be getting an invite. Mm-hmm. But like, I've done some research, and at the protocol level, I think it is going to be even more confusing than Mastodon is to use for the regular user. And I don't think that's a good thing if you're looking in the optics of like, oh, Blue Sky is more welcoming to normal people. It's like, yeah, that's only true right now because it's not actually trying to be an actual federated network. The second they flip that switch and it actually does it, there is going to be so much arcane bullshit piled onto this service that normal people will not want to interact with. And I think like it's maybe a smart decision that they've started rolling it out the way they did, where they're like, yeah, we have the protocol, but you can't really run your own server yet because nobody's implemented it anywhere. So yeah, I don't know. The AT protocol, honestly, I've looked into the documentation and it smells a lot of weird crypto bullshit.
Oh no.
Like,
oh no.
And it's not surprising given who it's coming from and other projects coming from these creators. But at the same time, it's like, you don't want to expose normal people to DIDs and a bunch of other arcane concepts that are just like arcane web standards that nobody uses really, except for the crypto world.
Right, right. So I guess we shall see what's happening in the coming months about the Twitter-like social network, because there's interesting news and interesting drama, dare I say?
It's not interesting. It's just drama.
Good. Speaking of drama, can I consider that our quickest follow-up ever? Or not the quickest, but our kind of fastest follow-up ever? Because literally 2 days after we released the episode, I guess my timing was correct by accident, but Apple has done something big that is directly related to our last episode titled Lead by Example. And oh boy, did Apple lead by example. So on May 9th, there was a press release released by Apple about them bringing Final Cut Pro and Logic Pro to the iPad.
Yeah, it's really funny because I'm pretty sure we've been begging for Final Cut to come to the iPad since the start of the podcast.
Right. And again, to not re-summarize the whole episode, it's literally your last episode. So if you skipped it, I strongly suggest you go watch it if you want to get my personal opinion about what's missing on the iPad. And the title is pretty much of a spoiler, but yeah, we need better desktop class application. And guess what? We're getting two of them from Apple. So the beloved Final Cut Pro app and Logic Pro are now coming on iPad. They are going to be released on May 23rd. So even if the announcement is nearly 2 weeks old at this point, 2 days after the release of this episode, they shall be available on the App Store. People start to have a lot of opinion, which I didn't read too much of the news following the announcement, but it is not as clear cut as we thought it would. I will start with Logic Pro because it seems that this one is more of a clear win, meaning that one of my biggest pet peeves from last episode was to say, it's nice to have more powerful application on the iPad, which we got in the last few years, but I always feel that for most of them, they're all, especially if they have an equivalent on the Mac, they always feel like a dumbed down version of that Mac app or a pro version of the iPhone app. And Logic Pro, from what we can read from the press release, we shall see on May 23rd. It seems to be more or less the same software. And one benefit is you can literally exchange your projects from Logic Pro on the Mac to Logic Pro on iOS. Again, let's wait for the reviews. Let's wait for people, the professionals, the audio gearheads to test this. But from the press review, that was clear. And the reason I say it was clear is because with Final Cut, it's interesting to me that they call it Final Cut Pro, because, again, the fact that it doesn't have fully compatible project definition with the Mac app reminds me of the old Final Cut Express version, which I had the opportunity to play with. So again, we're not a video producer or video editor, Yannick and I, but in a previous life, we had the opportunity to play with this. And I remember that with Final Cut Express, it was supporting a subset of functionality. And also that the project had to do into, if you want to move a project from Express to Pro, you had to have an import slash conversion project, and you can downgrade a Pro project back to Express. And it seems to be doing that too, which is interesting because I'm scrolling to my notes. They do mention that, again, you can import media, blah, 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 about from files and photos. But I think the important quote is this one. Final Cut Pro from iPad also supports the ability to import project created in iMovie for iOS. An iPad user can export their Final Cut Pro projects to the Mac. And there's a couple of caveats. I'll let you read. They need a specific version. But to me, that sounds more like, again, Final Cut Express on iPad, and it's the iMovie Pro and less that. So I'm eager to see what video producers, video editor will think about that. But I kind of wish, just from the press release, that we would have had a fully fledged video editor like the one we have on the Mac.
Well, we don't actually know what the complete feature set of what's going to be on the iPad right now is. So, I mean, it could still be like Final Cut Pro on the Mac is a very feature-rich application because it actually regained a lot of features from Final Cut Pro 7, I want to say, like the version before 10.
Yes.
That
it was 7.
Yeah, that a bunch of video producers were saying, like, I can't do my job without this feature. So they added a bunch of legacy features that Apple would have liked to not put in Final Cut. And it feels that this is kind of a similar reset where they're like, yeah, we understand that you, for your like 480i broadcast workflow, you need this thing, but we're not going to put it on the iPad because we're going to have a different set of assumptions. And because of that, we can't have file format parity or something like that. So I'm understanding of it. And if it's feature rich enough, it could potentially be better than LumaFusion. And I mean, like, that is something I might be interested in because I do video editing semi-regularly. So
yes,
I am excited about that. The other thing is, this reminds me of First Cut. Do you remember First Cut?
Wasn't it the nickname of Final Cut Pro 10?
No. It was the prototype version of iMovie 08, which was originally created to allow video producers to quickly piece together a draft version of a project that could be imported into the full version of Final Cut Pro on the Mac, which ultimately iMovie 08 did have this workflow, and iMovie for iOS also has this workflow, so it technically could be the First Cut as well. But having a more Final Cut version of that really smells like First Cut for me, and I don't know if that's the intended workflow here. But I thought that was really cool. But yeah, if the subset is rich enough, I'm going to be very interested in Final Cut. I'm a bit less interested in Logic. I think I was listening to Upgrade earlier today, and one of the things that Jason Snell mentioned, and I completely agree with this, is that it looks very much like an application that is anchored in traditional Apple user interface guidelines, which is to say it's going to work great with your finger and it's going to work great with the Apple keyboard and trackpad accessories. But the interactivity with Apple Pencil and multi-touch gestures is seemingly, right now anyway, much less ambitious than what FairRight is doing. And as I said on the last episode, pencil-based editing in FairRight is the most productive I have ever been editing audio, and I have trouble imagining that Apple has done as good a job as FairRight implementing that kind of editing into Logic, if they've implemented it at all. So there might be some usability catching up that Apple needs to do to compete with the other Pro apps that have been released in this vacuum when Apple didn't have Final Cut and Logic on the iPad. And I've seen, like, I'm sure there are going to be similar kind of paper cuts for LumaFusion users that are used to working in a certain workflow that is very productive. And then Final Cut is just like, we made a kind of touch version of the Final Cut UI, and it doesn't work as well on the iPad because it's less custom tailored for the iPad than something that would have been made specifically for the iPad from scratch.
Right, and that's why I was excited by this announcement, because of all the points you mentioned, it could imply, or not imply, but it could mean that Apple will realize internally that their own SDKs are not really well suited for dense information and functionality UIs.
Yeah.
And they'll have to build custom components for those own apps. And hopefully this feedback will get ported back to the developers that work on UIKit and Swift UI so that they can bring us those capabilities of building richer UI, denser information UI. So yeah, on that front, I was pretty excited up until I read that it's not fully fledged like the Mac version, even if it's possibly reinventing the flow like Final Cut 10 was, and even Logic Pro to a certain extent when it was kind of quote-unquote rebranded, but not rebranded. So pretty eager to see. To kind of end up that tangent and not transform this episode into the last episode again, one big change compared to Final Cut and Logic. I remember the price, which is around $300, I think Canadian dollars, maybe $400. So
yep.
Final Cut, for the quality of software it was pretty cheap, maybe a bit expensive for nerds like us just to buy it just for fun, but those two apps, Final Cut and Logic Pro, will be subscription based at $4.99 per month or $49 per year.
That is an insane deal.
Yeah, it is pretty cheap, and again, you could, and I could just, like, just for the sake of it, of playing and just not having to deal with iMovie and certain some of its limitation, you could just pay for it to do a video for 1 month and then call it a day.
Yeah.
The main downside, personally, for me, is that Final Cut Pro will require an Apple Silicon iPad, so an M1 base chip or later, whereas Logic Pro will ask for a A12 Bionic chip. So it seems that Final Cut Pro is going to be more CPU intensive, and that, I think, is a bit sad, knowing that in general the Apple Silicon chips that we got on iPads are pretty powerful. But yeah, it seems that they've decided that Final Cut Pro is going to be for the Pro iPads and the recent Pro iPads.
I think it makes a lot of sense because with the jump to M1 and onwards, there is a massive gap in sort of like video encoding quality,
right?
Performance.
Yeah.
And having an A12Z iPad and doing lots of video exporting on it, I can tell you, I would appreciate that change.
I'm not saying that this to me feels like, it's not that the older iPads are not capable. It's more like kind of Apple put their stick in the ground saying, okay, no, we feel that it's a shittier experience, but still.
I do think it is relevant for live effects previews, actually.
Interesting. But yeah, so I guess that's this long follow-up section about Apple doing what I kind of told them to, or I wonder if they were doing sooner rather than later, and they literally did mere days after our last episode.
All right.
Yeah, let's jump into your main topic.
Before I go in and sort of describe Microsoft's hellish last couple weeks, I want to check in with you, because you're kind of a non-derogatorily a casual gamer.
Okay, yes, that's fair. I think our past Game of the Year episodes have shown this.
I know that at this rate, you might only have like half of one game on your Game of the Year episode this year. So,
in my defense, I did play some Farming Simulator with my brother over this week.
Yeah, but you played that last year.
Agreed, but I think it is I think I played a bit in January, but it's the first time in a few months that we play, or I play at least, so... So, yeah.
Okay, but the question I'm going to ask you is, do you have any idea what is happening to Xbox right now?
To Xbox? Not exactly, but I wonder if it's related to the news of Microsoft buying Activision.
That is one of the things that happened recently. A lot of shit went wrong in a very short period of time, and it kind of resulted in Phil Spencer, the chief executive of Xbox, going onto a podcast during this dark week and giving a really candid interview about how he feels about the whole thing. Today's episode is going to be focusing on sort of the three things that are bringing down Xbox recently, and Phil Spencer's comments. The three things in question are, as you mentioned, the acquisition of Activision Blizzard King is facing increased scrutiny and pushback from antitrust regulators. The first-party studio's output is falling very short of player expectations. I'm thinking here kind of Halo Infinite, which there were mixed receptions for, and there was the whole pre-launch drama where the game looked like shit.
And got delayed.
Although, games getting delayed so they can be better is good, generally.
Agreed.
And then there was Redfall, which came out 2 weeks ago, which has been a disaster. So there's that. And then, underlying current of the last console generation as well, is that Xbox is having a very hard time catching up to the Switch and the PlayStation in terms of raw sales numbers. So let's start off with the ABK acquisition, just because I'm going to be shortening it because it's a lot of things. ABK is Activision Blizzard King. So Activision, maker of Call of Duty, Blizzard, maker of Warcraft, Starcraft, Overwatch, Diablo, all that great shit. And King is Candy Crush.
Maker of Slush Machine for kids.
Yeah, kids and grandmas. Basically, on January 18th, 2002, Microsoft announced that it wanted to acquire ABK for $68.7 billion. That's a crazy amount of money.
In 22, not 2002.
Oh, yes, correct. I can't read. And that meant acquiring all of those franchises I mentioned, but it also means all of the developer subsidiaries of Activision, so Treyarch, Raven Software, High Moon, Beenox, I misspelled it, Sledgehammer, Infinity Ward, Demonware, Toys for Bob, Activision Shanghai, and Solid State Studios. If you've never heard any of those names, those are all studios that make Call of Duty games, or one of them made the Spyro remasters.
Wow.
Yeah. And sort of the announcement pre-release tried to call out that this is about increasing the value proposition of Game Pass by being able to distribute for free as many of these banger games by these companies as possible to subscribers of the service. There are some weird things in there. So it would be for basically the same price as a World of Warcraft subscription. Technically, if this happened, you could get your World of Warcraft subscription and every Blizzard game and every Call of Duty game ever made in Game Pass, which is kind of crazy. And I wouldn't be surprised if Microsoft did that. It's a very enticing thing. And, of course, there were automatically assumptions like games are going to become exclusive to Xbox. You have all these banger franchises. You're not buying these studios just to continue releasing these games on PlayStation, right? You want to get value out of that by locking some things down to Xbox. And that resulted in a lot of arguing back and forth between Sony and Microsoft about the risk of Call of Duty being pulled from PlayStation. Microsoft kept pointing to Minecraft, which is another acquisition of theirs, as an example of a game that they own that's sort of too culturally important to be locked down on their own platforms. And they said, you can trust us, we're going to follow the same model. Unfortunately, platform holders like PlayStation and Nintendo and regulators have another Microsoft acquisition example that they can draw from, which is the Bethesda acquisition. With the Bethesda acquisition, that resulted in two high-profile in-development games being locked down to Xbox following the acquisition. Bethesda's Starfield and Arkane's Redfall, which we'll talk about later, those games were in development for PlayStation, and those versions were canceled as soon as Microsoft acquired Bethesda.
Hmm.
In October of 2022, Phil Spencer basically announced, I think in a tweet or something, that Call of Duty would ship on PlayStation as long as there is a PlayStation to ship it on. Which is
I remember this.
It's a really weird way of wording it, but he was like, well, we don't want to commit to shipping on a platform that doesn't exist if somehow it disappears.
Which is, it's kind of a semi-middle finger to Sony to kind of say, if you die next generation, and you still say, oh, it's because of you. That's like, no, it's not because of us. Well, like, if you invent a new console, then it's not named PlayStation, and we also have an easy way out. And
yeah, it's a nice weasel word situation. PlayStation actually responded by saying, like, it's cool that you tweeted this, but we can't actually agree to this informal commitment. We want something in in writing, which is smart, really.
It sounds like some lawyers at Sony were the one responding to Phil Spencer's tweets.
Yeah. And then in November of 2022, Microsoft offered a 10-year deal to Sony to keep Call of Duty on PlayStation. And the idea was that, like, people argued about the 10-year thing because, like, Phil Spencer said, as long as PlayStation exists, yes. Right? So that seems like you've wound down the number of things. And he was just like, well, our lawyers told us we have to put an end date on this. So we chose 10 years and we have every intent of renewing it after 10 years. But we can't just write that in the thing. Otherwise, our lawyers will freak out, which is kind of weird.
You know what, Nick? Sorry for this tangent, but I think I want to be at some point in my life where my job is to make Lara freak out on purpose.
It seems
the best job ever.
Until you get, like, slapped with papers by the lawyers, then it's less fun.
Possibly.
A month after that, in December of 2022, the U.S. Federal Trade Commission attempted to block the acquisition, and they pointed to their track record with the acquisition of Bethesda, where titles in development were changed to become exclusives, even though they told the European authorities that they had no incentive to do that, which is kind of dirty. Then in a few weeks ago, on April 26th, the UK Competition and Markets Authority blocked the acquisition, claiming that since Microsoft already controls 60 to 70% of the cloud gaming subscription market, making Activision games exclusive to Game Pass could easily make them a monopoly in that space. And Microsoft said that they'd be appealing the decision. And this is really interesting. Like, there has been some debate as to whether or not the CMA's methodology for counting Microsoft's market share in the cloud gaming market is accurate, because they seem to be counting all Game Pass subscribers as cloud gaming users, which is not technically true. Only Game Pass Ultimate users have access to streaming games, and technically not all Ultimate users are necessarily using xCloud on a daily basis, right?
Yeah, it's just one perk of the Ultimate.
Exactly. I know lots and lots of people who have Game Pass and have never touched xCloud, so it's kind of a weird way of wording it. I suppose you could say, like, all of these people could become cloud gaming users without spending a cent, and maybe that is a valid way of accounting for Ultimate users at the very least, but I don't think it's necessarily accurate to portray it like that. Their point still sort of stays true, though. I sort of think that now that Stadia is gone, yes, Microsoft is almost undoubtedly the market leader in cloud gaming, and if you flip a switch and you say, hey, all of the Blizzard games, all the Activision games, and I guess Candy Crush are now on Game Pass, go wild, and you can stream them anywhere on any device, you are going to see a lot more people, because those are very desirable games. Now, the counterpoint to all of this is that Call of Duty is a 60 FPS first-person shooter, and Overwatch is a 60 FPS first-person shooter. You don't really want to be playing those games on cloud streaming, because you're going to be at a massive disadvantage over literally anyone else who is playing on a real native platform because of the lag inherent in cloud streaming. So I'm not sure those games are going to be the most attractive for cloud gamers. Maybe something like Diablo is more acceptable, where it's more of a slower paced top-down action RPG type thing. But even then, like StarCraft and Warcraft, like they have the term actions per minute for a reason. Like, you are doing a crazy amount of actions if you're playing competitively in these games, and you are also going to be in a disadvantage. So unless you're just playing story mode or something, like, I don't see the appeal of necessarily streaming that over the cloud.
I know you mentioned Stadia, but you didn't mention NVIDIA GeForce Now.
Yeah.
is, I'll call it xCloud, just to say that we talk about the cloud streaming services, and it's simpler than just saying Game Pass, blah, 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 blah. But is xCloud compatible with that? Like, because I remember that with, on the NVIDIA services, you can just log into your Steam account and then just play your game there.
I guess technically, I think you can use the Xbox launcher to log into Game Pass for PC and play Game Pass PC games on GeForce Now. I can't say I've really looked into it.
Okay.
But yeah, I was mostly thinking more about the console side of things, honestly. I think more of it as an Xbox product, because from what I've heard from PC Game Pass users, PC Game Pass is apparently like very close to unusable because the Windows Store is a trash fire.
Oh, you need to use the Windows Store? Oh, that's bad.
Yes, and I have heard horror stories from people who were downloading games. The games would get glitched, and you had to reinstall Windows to clear the install files. Yes.
Oh, that's so painful.
Because it's like in a locked partition that only the system can touch. Oh, and crap. Because it was glitched, you couldn't do anything. I think I've heard that they've since fixed this, but this was a big problem that many of my friends and even Digital Foundry were getting hit by semi-regularly, and they were really pissed, and they stopped using Game Pass on PC because of it. So, yeah. But going back to all of this, like, immediately following that CMA announcement, they were blocking the acquisition. Microsoft made some more deals with more companies. So they signed a 10-year deal with Nintendo, of all people, to say, hey, Call of Duty is going to be on Nintendo consoles now, which is very strange. Like, it hasn't been on a Nintendo console since the Wii, I'm pretty sure. Maybe there was one on the Wii U. But generally, like, Nintendo consoles get, like, really bad ports because they're low-performance versions of the games. They can't run the full fat version that's on every other console because the hardware is underpowered. And, like, implying that, like, I can't wait to see Warzone running on the Switch. That's going to be a disaster. But they did that. They also signed a deal with GeForce Now to say, hey, if you're worried about us making games, ABK games, cloud exclusive to Game Pass, we are not doing that. GeForce Now is going to be allowed to have all these games as well. So yeah, like, I mean, it's, they seem to be living up to their promise of saying, hey, we're going to be treating this like Minecraft. Don't be worried. Call of Duty is not going to become an Xbox exclusive tomorrow morning, and you're going to have to find a new first-person shooter to play instead. Although, I will say, a positive thing about a Ubisoft game for the first time in my life, X-Defiant from Ubisoft, which is basically just Call of Duty with different maps from Ubisoft games, looks absolutely awesome. And I can't wait to play that when that comes out on consoles. So if you're looking for a Call of Duty alternative, if you ever have to ditch Call of Duty because it goes Xbox exclusive, X-Defiant looks great. So I want to go to the Phil Spencer interview, because I thought there was something really interesting about the way he talked about it. He said, like, naturally, they're going to be appealing the thing, and they think it's sad because, like, of course the company is going to be sad that the acquisition they want to make it didn't get approved. Like, what did you expect? He was going to say, ah, I agree with the regulators. Like, I don't know. But he said, the Activision acquisition is not our strategy. It is just an accelerant in our strategy. And what I've interpreted from that is, we're all in agreement. Well, I'm not, but like, Xbox is in agreement that Game Pass is the future of gaming, and that this subscription model is what the business is going to be moving to. And I mean, if you look at Sony and the new PlayStation Plus tiers, they are becoming more and more competitive with Game Pass because I think they felt the pressure from Game Pass. So more and more companies are getting on that bandwagon. And really, if they want to maintain a solid lead, they need as many games on there to sweeten the value proposition of Game Pass. And Activision Blizzard, maybe not King, would be a massive boost to that. Because if you're a Game Pass subscriber, you would effectively never have to buy an Activision or Blizzard game again. And if you're playing if you're already paying for Game Pass and you're used to buying Call of Duty for $80 every year, now you're just going to get that for free. And that is a compelling offer, I think. How do you feel about it?
It would be a compelling offer, I guess, if you don't want to make money, because Activision is making a shit ton of money by selling you the game every year. So while I see it as a push for it, like, the monthly cost is still kind of, I guess, how much is the Game Pass per month for the Ultimate plan?
I think it's something like $13 Canadian.
Yeah, okay, so you can end up paying a bit more than one game at retail price for the whole year.
Yep.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm not sure what really to think about that.
The other thing I would add is I'm actually kind of shocked that Call of Duty hasn't gone fully free-to-play, because there is so much Battle Pass and other premium currency shit in those games now that they're also just making a ton of money off of microtransactions in those games that I don't really know how significant the boxed product price is in the overall earnings of Call of Duty. Like, even just, like, I haven't played a Call of Duty game since Black Ops 4, right? That's still a far right. ways back. I think that was the first one to ship with an in-game battle pass and loot boxes and all of that stuff for cosmetics. Maybe not the first for loot boxes, but I'm pretty sure it was the first one with the battle pass. And that was pushed pretty heavily the entire time. And when I look at, like, of course, like, this is going to be biased to a certain degree, but when I look at Call of Duty YouTubers, like, they have a ton of bling on all their stuff, and it's not just from the freebies they get from play hours. Like, they must spend a ton of money on those too. So I think like any game with microtransactions, like, there are going to be heavy spenders, and I think the heavy spenders spend a lot more than anyone actually expects, and that they could be offsetting a lot of stuff. So, I don't know. There's still a lot of potential for making money on these games beyond just getting the base game for free.
Right. No, for sure. But it is an interesting play, knowing that Call of Duty is quite the cash cow for Activision. So, to kind of split the business model. I'm eager to see what Microsoft will do it. By the way, just a quick note, there are free-to-play Call of Duty games now.
Yeah, Warzone and Warzone 2.
Yes, but they're not that. I think you were more hitting at the fact that they're not main franchises games. Is that what you meant?
I mean, at this point, Warzone is probably bigger than base Call of Duty, I would imagine. That's because it's free-to-play.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I found the comment weird about that they don't have free to play games.
Yeah, but I mean, like, I don't know. I feel like Call of Duty could become somewhat like music games. Like, Beatmania 2DX it's very strange, but the game technically hasn't changed really, hasn't had a version up, like a real version up under the hood in like 10 years. They just changed the title screen to say a different name, but and they changed the skin, but it's the same game under it.
Right, I see what you mean.
So, like, they could do that with Call of Duty and just, like, fuck around with the physics parameters if you're in space or something, and it wouldn't be quite as exciting as an all-new Call of Duty, like in the Treyarch engine versus in the Sledgehammer engine or whatever, when the different developers make different Call of Duty games. Like, I understand that there is some appeal to that, and, like, I like the Treyarch Call of Duty, so I would be sad if they used some other company's engine to do it. But at the same time, it feels like you might as well. They've become so formulaic by now. That you feel it feels like a lot of wasted work to not be reusing those components regularly if you're just making those formulaic games every year. But I don't know. Maybe that's how you lose the soul of Call of Duty, if it's not already lost.
Oi.
Yeah. And you can also go look at EA and Battlefield's attempts at trying to resolve that, and how that was also a disaster in the last year for more ideas of how that could go wrong. But let's move on to the next point, which is first party studio output and Redfall. So ABK is just one of many acquisitions that Xbox has been doing over the past few years. I think they've snapped up like 25 studios in the last generation of consoles. just trying to build up its portfolio of internal studios that can create compelling Xbox exclusives. And as I mentioned earlier, as part of the Bethesda ZeniMax acquisition, Microsoft snapped up Arkane Studios, which is a studio that was involved with massive first-person shooter hits such as Prey, Deathloop, and the Dishonored series. And I believe all of these games were in the conversation for the game of the year for the games for the years of their release. So these are big deal games. Personally, I'm very curious about the Dishonored games. They've always looked really cool to me, and I would like to play them someday. But I have too many games to play. So naturally, expectations were very high for Redfall, which was Arkane's next game. And it was going to be the first high-profile Xbox exclusive game to come out of that acquisition. Deathloop technically came out after the Microsoft acquisition, but they had an existing agreement to be exclusive to the PS5 for a year, so they honored it, which is very nice of Microsoft, because I don't think they had to do it. But they wanted to do the right thing for PlayStation fans, which is very odd, because now you can go buy a PlayStation game with an Xbox logo on it.
Interesting, yeah?
Yeah. So Redfall came out on May 2nd, 2023, and it was a massive flop. It was ranking at 56 Metacritic score and 3.4 out of 10 user score. So not great. And this is
It flopped because it was bad or because of the acquisition?
Because it was bad.
Oh, okay.
And it was bad on so many different fronts. So the first thing is the pre-launch messaging around this game was really unclear and confusing. Despite not owning an Xbox, I watch all the Xbox press events. So I know all the games that are coming out on Xbox because that's just what I do. And I did not actually know what this game actually was until it came out. I think most people thought it was going to be a game like Left 4 Dead, basically a horde shooter where you kill vampires instead of zombies. That's not exactly what that game is. It's actually just Destiny with vampires. I didn't know this from watching the game footage, which is a bad sign.
Destiny with vampires?
Yeah. Just replace all of the aliens and the weird creatures with vampires and other humans. And that's kind of what the game is. It's an open world multiplayer shooter with PvE that you can play co-op with your friends. And you get loot and you upgrade your loot and you shoot vampires.
Wow.
Yeah. Again, I didn't know that's what the game was. I found out when I was watching the reviews when they came out after launch. So you kind of fucked up your messaging if nobody knows what your game is, at the very least. Then the game had a ton of technical issues and bugs. So a few weeks prior to launch, Arkane announced that the game would be capped at 30 FPS at launch, which disappointed a lot of people because Xbox likes to say that they are the most powerful console ever, and then they ship an exclusive on their console, first-party exclusive, that has 30 FPS cap. And I understand that there were technical difficulties in getting the 60 FPS mode to run at launch, and they have said there will be a performance mode coming later. But a lot of the enthusiasm for the game was just sucked out when they announced that.
So your performance mode is, ooh, it's running at 60 FPS, whereas on the PS4, the performance mode might be 120.
Well, Xbox can do that too, right? They actually could do that on Xbox One as well, if you had an Xbox One X. Obviously, Redfall is struggling to target 60. I don't think they're going to be targeting 120.
Sure.
And, I just want to be fair that some games can justify 30 FPS, although it's becoming harder to do so this generation because sort of they've set the standard that everything is going to have a performance mode, or almost everything will. So games can justify 30 FPS if their visuals are particularly stunning, or if they're doing something so systematically intensive that 60 FPS is not possible because of the CPU overhead. But Redfall doesn't look that impressive, and oftentimes it just looks like a bad PS4 game, which is not good. It can take up to 10 to 20 seconds for textures to load in. The shadows and lighting are unacceptably poor. Sometimes the enemy AI just breaks, and it just doesn't react to anything, and it just stands there, and you can just shoot them in the head and nothing happens. There's lots of stutter when traveling through the world, and shockingly for a console game, especially a first party one, the controller's support sucks. If you try to aim, everybody complains about how hard it is to shoot with controller, and this is a console exclusive game. Well, I guess it's technically on PC too, but that was also a disastrous port. And in fact, it was kind of in the running for worst PC port with Jedi Survivor from the week before. So it's a great month for PC gamers. But on top of that, it doesn't sound like the game is fun at all. Here's a quote from Digital Foundry's John Linneman, which I think John Linneman is very kind to games that are not that good generally. So this is especially damning. This is the quote. "Most of this world is devoid of anything resembling gameplay."
Whoa. Okay, that's harsh.
Yeah. I mean, like, it's still remaining quite diplomatic because I know John doesn't like shitting on games for the sake of shitting on games, but he was disappointed with this one. Missions largely consist of traversal between objective waypoints on giant empty maps with only a handful of enemies sprinkled here or there. I think I saw a review where they actually played a fast motion clip of the entire mission and there were three enemies in like a 15-minute mission, which is bad for a shooting game where you collect guns to ideally shoot other enemies with.
But that's okay. You don't need to collect gun. There's no enemies.
Well, then the entire point of the game doesn't really make sense then, does it?
I guess. Maybe it's just to wander around empty lands.
There are games for that too, that are better than this one. Also, the technical issues I mentioned earlier sometimes can cause mission objectives to break and to be impossible to complete, meaning you have to restart the entire mission, which is not fun.
Oh no, that's bad.
So, mission objectives aren't interesting. The cutscenes aren't engaging, and the skill trees make no fucking sense. For example, if you check out the stealth tree, ideally you'd think the stealth tree, well, it's about sneaking around and killing your enemies being undetected, right?
I guess.
Okay. Well, the stealth tree eventually gives you an upgrade that when you see an enemy, it sends out a bunch of crows to attack the enemies. Do you see the problem with this? It immediately alerts them to your presence, which is
right. That's kind of not
opposite
subtle.
Of the fantasy of the stealth tree. So, like, stealth players were pissed at this game because they couldn't actually play it the way they thought they could because they took the stealth skill tree. So there are lots of design issues inherent in this game where, like, thought wasn't really put into all of this stuff, or like, there are modifiers which are like, oh, 150% headshot damage to this kind of enemy. Well, if you don't have that perk, the enemy just dies to a single headshot anyway, so why do I care that I have 150% damage buff? The game has, wow, like, literally dozens of these kinds of mods that make no sense, and it's just nodes on a skill tree that you unlock for the sake of having the complete skill tree lit up, but it's completely useless.
And oh, that's painful.
Naturally, everyone was wondering how this game was allowed to ship, because there are usually checks and balances in game studios to avoid that being the case. One of them being mock reviews. So you will go to various game reviewers that you've hired either in-house or there are agencies outside that do this, and you send them your game, and they play the game, and they write a review like any other reviewer would. And Phil Spencer said on that podcast that the internal mock reviews for this game were far more positive than actual reviews were, double digits higher than what they were in real life. And to me, that signals a giant issue with how your mock reviews are being done internally, because anyone who has watched a few minutes of gameplay of this game knows that there's something wrong immediately with it. And it's kind of weird. Another comment Phil made was, "Telemetry shows that the crash rate is not out of proportion with other newly launched titles." And that reminds me a lot of when Apple talks about issues, when they say, oh, well, the crash rate is really low, so I guess the issue can't be that bad. Some issues aren't crashes. In fact, most of these issues aren't crashes. That doesn't mean that they're not significantly harming the playability of the game. And I think to some degree, when we were talking about the Destiny development cycle a couple episodes ago, and they were saying like, oh, well, when you're making a game as a service, day one is just the start. Like the launch day is just the start of your adventure. And then you have to continually fix the game and fix the game and fix the game. That doesn't mean you should ship a shitty game. So when Phil was asked about why Redfall wasn't delayed, this was his answer, quote, "If I think about a team's execution on a game, there's a creative vision. And did we realize that creative vision through the game that we created? That's not a delay if the answer to that question is no. We will build games that review in the high 80s, and we will build games that review in the 60s. It's just part of being in game publishing, and if you're afraid of that, then you shouldn't be in the entertainment business, much less than the games business." So the way I interpret that quote is there is a creative vision in this game. It was poorly executed, but because there was a creative vision in this game, and they were able to execute it, although poorly, then you can't delay the game. Because bugs are not high enough priority to delay the game. And that is a massive red flag to me about Xbox's development practices, if this is the way they're doing things, because it means your AAA exclusive games, which are generally going to be boxed product games and not like free-to-play games as a service things, they live and they die by their first impressions. And therefore, you can't just patch out the bugs later. You have to actually care about the quality of what you ship on that disc.
Right. And on top of that, yes, you mentioned a lot of bugs, but it seems like you like the impression of the game was like the creative vision was not well executed, not because, but just because it was a poor execution. Mm-hmm. So it could have been literally core or foundational things that, yeah, you have to, I don't say rewrite the game, but kind of say like we have to go back to the drawing board to execute on that creative vision. And that is hard to fix.
It is hard to fix, but then at that point, should the game be canceled or are you just going to ship it anyway?
Yeah, then that's the, is it a fallacy of sunk cost or something like that?
Sunk cost, right? Fallacy, yeah.
Yes. So yeah, it seems that that's still what drives Microsoft.
Yep. So for the last section of this episode, I want to talk about Xbox being stuck in third place. And I think this is personally the part of the episode of the podcast that was the most interesting for me. So I'm going to read a lot of quotes from Phil Spencer. I don't really have any commentary about it. I just want to talk about it after we've read these things, because I think he has captured something that has been in the back of my mind for a while now, but I just didn't know how to verbalize it. And when I heard it, I was like, that's what I've been feeling about the last console generation. So
just before you go, I know you mentioned that, like, I know they've been third place, but like I kind of forgot the order. Like, is Sony first and then Nintendo, or is Nintendo first?
No, it's Nintendo by a lot.
Right, just because of number of consoles sold, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So yeah. So here's the quote from Uncle Phil. There's no world where Starfield is an 11 out of 10 and people start selling their PS5s. That's not going to happen. We lost the worst generation to lose in the Xbox One generation, where everybody built their digital library of games. We want the Xbox community to feel awesome, but this idea that if we just focus more on great games on our console, that we're somehow going to win the console race doesn't relate to the reality of most people. Like 90% of the people every year who walk into a retailer to buy a console are already a member of one of the three ecosystems, and their digital library is there. This is the first generation where the big games they're playing were games that were available last gen. When you think about Fortnite and Roblox and Minecraft, the continuity from generation to generation is so strong. I see a lot of pundits out there who want to go back to the time when we all had cartridges and discs and every new generation was a clean slate and you could change the whole console share, but that's just not the world that we're in today. I know some people want to hold us up as being a better green version of what the blue guys do. I'm just going to say there's not a win for Xbox in staying in the wake of somebody else. We have to go off and do our own thing with Game Pass, with the stuff we do with xCloud and the way we build our games. So that is really interesting. I had not really realized that the digital library was lock-in all of this time, but it totally is.
Mm-hmm.
And like, yeah, I mean, Game Pass is kind of a way to offset that, because if enough of the games that you own on the other system is available through Game Pass and you're planning to be a Game Pass subscriber, then you aren't really losing those games, although you are losing your saves. And if you have like a multiplayer game that doesn't have cross save or something like that, then you're going to lose any sort of spending you've done on that game or any records you've done or stuff like that. So, like, there is some level of investment that can be lost, but if you're mostly playing single-player games, like, I think it is possible to switch, and I have friends who have switched, largely due to Game Pass, sort of supplanting the games that they had owned on previous consoles and giving it to them for free on Xbox with that monthly subscription. But yeah, that was really, really interesting. And it's true that I, despite having a PS5, I'm playing more last-gen games than ever. Because that's kind of what we have on PS5, aside from, like, a handful of exclusives a year that are really worthwhile and worth checking. You sort of just have, like, cross-gen games and PS4 games that are running in PS4 Pro mode to play on. And at the same time, like, I have a massive backlog of games, so I'm not complaining. But even though I knew that, I hadn't realized that it was acting as lock-in, and it was that was holding Xbox back the whole time.
It's interesting to use. I agree. Like, when you read the quote and everything, it also clicked in my mind. But I cannot remove the feeling that it's also kind of an excuse. Because more or less what he's saying is, we rocked the PS3 to Xbox 360 generation, but we should add focus on, like, digital catalog earlier, or kind of realize that we need to transfer some of that success into the next generation because the next one was more important, I guess.
I want to add some context, though, which is that remember that Xbox One launched with horrible, horrible messaging and TV, 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 TV.
First, and then the you cannot share games and the loan thing that I forgot, or the digital renting system.
Yes, and Kinect being obligatory and all of that stuff.
Right.
Like, they lost a lot of goodwill from gamers there, and Phil Spencer was hired to clean up that mess. So a lot of the bad decisions that were done that fucked Xbox badly last generation were things that happened before Phil was there, and he has been trying to fix it up. And I think for the large part, he has said all of the right things. I don't think Xbox has been able to execute as well as they had wanted to, and I think Phil is also very conscious of that. Like, for example, last year at their E3 conference, they showed a whole list of games, and they said all of these games are going to be shipping in 12 months, and then, like, half of those games ended up being delayed. Like, it makes sense because of the pandemic and shit, but still. Yeah.
It kind of goes back to saying, if we would be 10 times better or 100 times better than Sony and first-party game on that platform, we would still not beat them, which is kind of... That's where I feel uneasy about that. I mean, it's kind of like, so you're kind of already accepting that you're, I'll use a strong word, a loser in that segment. So again, it's trying, and it's, I think it's nice for them to say, like, okay, let's find a way to change the game so that we're already upfront for the next thing. And that, to kind of quote their CEO when they were talking about AI, oh, we want Google to dance, right? I think it's interesting as a quote, but at the same time, it's also kind of saying, like, oh yeah, but we realize that we're not good at just giving you games you want to buy. So we'll give them for you for free, and hopefully you'll just pay us every month and trust that 3 years from now, after paying like $13 per month for the next 3 years, that you'll have enough game that it was worth it, even if then you decide to go back to Sony's console and end up with literally zero catalog of games.
Well, that's the thing that's really funny, is like, if you had to choose one console, how many games and what games would you need to have on Xbox to make the Switch? And I don't really have a good answer for Xbox.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, my loyalty is to Gran Turismo.
Even if that's dwindling, I would say.
Yeah, that's true. And I think Forza is actually in a similar situation, where I think the game does very well to a casual audience, but to Forza fans, the Forza games are going downhill. So there's an interesting sort of parallel thing going on with Forza over there. But yeah, I honestly wouldn't be able to tell you what Xbox would need. To be honest, what they need is something that Xbox has traditionally failed at, is they would need to go to Japanese developers and ask the Japanese developers to make exclusives for the Xbox, which they kind of did on the Xbox 360, except only in Japan, so I never got to actually play those games.
Of course.
Yeah. But like, there has been like one Japanese developed Xbox exclusive in the whole last generation. So it's like, I don't think you're going to be drawing me over with one game.
Yeah, it goes back to all the big games that we talk about. They're all on non-Microsoft consoles, or I guess PCs.
Yeah, everything is either a Sony exclusive, an Xbox exclusive, or a multi-platform. And if the Xbox exclusives aren't as good as the Sony exclusives, it's a really tough sell to go on Xbox.
See, I would have said it differently. Either it's a Sony exclusive, either it's a PC exclusive, because it's just a game that only runs on PC, or it's a Nintendo IP and then there's the rest.
Oh, wow. You don't even count Xbox exclusive as their own thing?
No. I would have included Nintendo IP, though, but...
That's another thing I want to mention that I sort of overlooked in my prep for this episode, is that basically everything that is on Xbox Game Pass also exists on PC. Generally, every Microsoft-published game for the Xbox is also given a PC release, which makes sense to some degree. Like, you can buy all of those games in the Xbox section of the Windows Store, which, like... You heard what I said about the Windows Store earlier. You don't need me to repeat it.
No, and see, that's my kind of recent problems with Xbox console for the last two generations, like the current one and the previous one. Like, when it was the Xbox 360, it was still closer to what Sony was doing, as it was kind of still more or less a PC in a box, unlike what Sony is doing. But now, with more or less Sony and Microsoft building just PCs in a box, in a fancier box, what is the argument for PC gamer that are traditionally buying games and things like that, or even paying for a Game Pass, buying an Xbox console? I don't see the benefit for that. Whereas right now, it seems that Sony, by bringing port of those games, is trying to slowly but surely say, hey, PC gamer, you've heard about those great games that we have as first-party titles. We will give them to you, but if you want them faster, just buy a PS5. And
yeah,
then you'll be able to experience them at the same time. Yes, 3 years down the road, when we need to make another cash grab, so you buy them all, we'll release it. And that's kind of the more recent strategy of those ports. But... it is giving an argument for buying a PS5 as a PC gamer. I don't see that for Xboxes.
Yeah, that makes a really good point. And especially with like the, what was it called? The PC gaming crisis, I think they called it on Digital Foundry, where PC ports are getting worse and worse. the argument for PC gamers has never been weaker. So I don't know. It's tough sell even to go to PC gaming nowadays. So that pretty much covers everything I wanted to talk about regarding Xbox. It's been a really interesting couple of weeks listening to what's going on with Xbox. I do highly recommend you go listen to that episode of the Kind of Funny Xcast if you're vaguely interested in this stuff, because... like, I might not be the biggest Xbox fan, but I have tremendous respect for the transparency that Phil Spencer has. And during his tenure, we also got the fabulous 20th anniversary documentary about Xbox, which was, like, aside from the fact that they could have captured better video of their games, it was really, really cool, and it showed a lot of transparency as to what actually happened during the Red Ring of Death whole situation for the Xbox 360, that you would never see a company make a documentary about themselves and actually own up to their mistakes like that, which I have tremendous respect for. So I love Phil Spencer, maybe not the biggest Xbox fan, but I think he's doing a great job and he's saying the right things. I just want to see Xbox get a win at some point so that he actually gets to feel good about what he's doing.
Right, right. You mentioned that he's been in the Xbox division for the last 10 years?
Has it been 10 years since the 360? Almost, yeah. Yeah, 10
wow,
years.
Wow, okay. Yeah, no, I get your point that he has shaken up the Xbox division, put it back on track, and again, we could describe some of those as hiccups, whether they're small or big, but still is kind of driving this vision for the last decade. But you're correct to say, and I'll make a more Quebec Montreal equivalent hockey joke here as a non-hockey fan, but still it's kind of like all the Montrealers reminiscent of the Montreal Canadian winning the Stanley Cup. It's like, oh, it happened in 93. It's like, yes, but 93 is literally nearly as a little bit younger than me. Like
I was 2 years old.
Exactly. So at some point, they need to win to show that their commitment and what the vision, what their changes were worth it. Because in the end, I don't want to make it like kind of a winner / loser, but it kind of still like that. Like is you do changes, but you're not improving your situation. And I think it might end up that they might just gave up at some point.
There were rumors about like Microsoft Direction being disappointed in the performance of Xbox and potentially cutting it. So like that's not off the table, but I hope they don't. It would be really sad to just be PlayStation and Nintendo at the same time. Like that's actually the case in Japan.
Yeah, and if you think about the future with cloud gaming, like I'm eager to see what Nintendo and Sony will do for that, because that shakes their quote unquote profit margins. We know that they sell the Sony sells the console at like base minimum profit or even at the loss, and then they recoup with the games. But if it's just a subscription service, your margins changes heavily. Mm-hmm. And if they transition the Xbox as a physical thing to a software thing, literally with xCloud, yeah, it's going to be interesting, because in the end with xCloud they could literally keep your Xbox controller, put the same Wi-Fi technology that we had in the Stadia controller, so that just like the Stadia controller is the thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
To go to Stadia, they could do that with the xCloud, right? And then just get rid of the Xbox console, and that would be quite the move if they end up going there.
They did actually have a prototype for a Chromecast type box for xCloud. And it's actually on the shelf behind Phil Spencer when he does press events. It's like when he uses that office, it's literally behind him. He just takes it out sometimes and shows it to people. So like it has existed and it was very close to shipping, but they actually canned it because they were like, we'd rather go in the Series S direction. Yeah. And I think that's a wiser move in terms of quality of experience. The other thing I want to mention is technically the highest PlayStation Plus tier is already doing what you're saying. You can already stream the entire catalog of those PlayStation Plus Premium, Extra. I don't know the tiers.
But with the new tiers, it's just kind of what Microsoft has done is they don't have a subscription for xCloud. It's just part of the benefits. And Sony used to be like you have PS Now and PS Plus, and now it's just tiers in the PSN Plus catalog. So I guess, but they're still sending you a PS5, right?
But you don't need it. You don't need it. You can just buy the PS Plus thing and you can stream it from the cloud.
Oh,
except it's so poorly marketed that nobody knows.
Right. I did not know that.
Typical Sony.
Yeah, that you could just buy the plan and just go on the web browser and interesting.
Yeah, you can just use the app on the phone or the app on the... Well, maybe not the app on the phone. I guess they're in the same situation as Xbox, right?
Right.
But yeah, you can use the web browser and go download the app on Mac or PC and you can just log in and play. Or if you have a PS4, you can actually log in and play PS5 games.
Oh, through the cloud.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Anyway, that's it.
Good. You can find all the show notes for this episode at limitlesspossibility.net/206 to 206. You can also find our back catalog of episodes at limitlesspossibility.net. The show is on Fediverse. We are at limipo_podcast. That's limipo_podcast at mastodon.social. You can also find us individually on the Fediverse. I am at Luco at mastodon.social. That's LUCCO. And you can find Yannick at
Sakarina at icosahedron.website.
And we'll see you in 2 weeks.
See you in 2 weeks.